Hey, everybody, it's me here, Michael Franti, on the Stay Human podcast. Man, we are super excited because we've got a new album that is coming out. It's called Work Hard and Be Nice. 17 songs, that's right, you heard it, 17 songs filled with optimism and stories about how we get through challenging times and still hold on to our humanity. We can't wait to get back out on the road with you guys, so stay tuned to all of my socials. You'll get the information first about when we're going to be touring next. In the meantime, enjoy all the songs on the album, Work Hard, Be Nice. You can Spotify it. You can stream it all over the place. You can download it on iTunes. You can even get the CD from michaelfranti.com. So check it out.
To the Michael Franti Stay Human podcast. This is our number 4 podcast, and we finally have a name for the show. You haven't heard about this, but we've been trying to come up with a name for the show, and some people wrote into us and said, how about Stay Human? And we've got a lot of stuff in our history about Stay Human. You know the record?
Yeah.
You guys know the record? All right. So we decided to call it the Stay Human Podcast. And we're very excited because our very special guest today is a band that we've been touring with over the last couple weeks. And we've done a bunch of shows with earlier in the year. And they're one of my favorite new bands anywhere. And their name is Satsang. And we got Drew here.
Heyo.
Drew! We got Keller. And we got Carl. Yeah. Right on. So let's just start from the beginning. How did you guys all meet?
So I started the band 3 years ago with one other person after a trip to Nepal. I'd like written this collection of songs and I came home and started playing music. And then Carl and I actually lived together in Chicago like 10 years ago. We met when I was like 18.
Okay.
And we lived together for a while. But after I started the project, I kind of wanted to change it, so invited Carl out to join. And then right when he joined it, I stole Keller. He was playing in like an organ trio, and I saw him in Missoula, Montana, and stole him fair and square from another band.
Well, right on. So, nice.
But yeah, so here we are. We've been playing us three for like 18 months now.
Wow.
But like heavy, you know?
Yeah.
Like over 100 a year last year, I think.
Nice. And you were just mentioning that you're in Nepal. Tell me about that. What was that about?
I initially went over as a climber and like a mountaineer mindset.
Whoa.
So
backtrack, man. Okay. A climber? And yeah. Like you're climbing what? You're climbing like.
Well, so there's
Kathmandu. Like
well,
K2,
so we hung out in Kathmandu. And obviously, everyone goes over there for Everest, right? And
yeah.
I am. Lobache, and there's all these other peaks over there.
Yeah.
I had saw pictures of a small village called Kenjoma, and it's funny that your partner's wearing a bouldering t-shirt, because I went over there, I saw these pictures, and I was like, I know that these are climbable.
Yeah.
And a guy that I worked at a climbing shop with was a guide over there, and he's like, I'm going there this spring by myself, you should just come with me.
Yeah.
So I went over there as a climber.
Just come with me and hang off a 20,000-foot rock and see if you can climb up it.
See if you dig it. So we did this huge traverse that was the most like physically taxing thing I've ever done in my life of the Everest region. We did a big circle, but I stayed in Kenjoma and bouldered for a while.
Is this with like full-on like Sherpas and tons of gear?
Well, we didn't bring any Sherpas. It was just him and me with everything on our back for 5 weeks.
Wow.
And it was on like day three that I visited Pashupudana, which is where they cremate everybody, and then following that, I went to the Buddhist temple, monkey temple.
Did you go there specifically thinking like I'm about to check out? I want to make sure I'm in the right place in case I need to be cremated. After this climb.
Is this how I want to do it? No, but it, you know, it's just like if you've ever been to that part of the world, about 3 days in was like, I'm not here to climb, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And
it became a soul adventure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had, like, so much healing to do. You know, like, I struggled with alcoholism. I came from an abusive home. I, like, pretty much been on my own since I was, like, 17. And the trip really became a place where I, like, began to, like, actually process these things and change my perspective on, it was the first time the phrase, like, man, maybe all this stuff happened for you and not to you.
Right.
You know, and maybe there's a greater purpose. Maybe all this stuff happened to you to prime you for your dharma.
Right.
And it was there that I was like, okay, music is it for
sure. Nice. And so at this point, were you writing songs that became part of this project?
Yeah, okay. That's where I wrote the we still play two of those original songs that I wrote on that trip. A song called I Am, and then every once in a while we'll play Make It Better.
Okay, so let's get to your name, because I feel like this story is maybe contains part of your name.
Yeah,
because for most people in America, they heard the word satsang and they're thinking like, I don't even know what they're thinking.
Yeah.
Thinking like, oh, that's a unique name. Yeah. Like look at her face. Yeah. She's got the hands up. She's going.
So most people say satsang because phonetically that's how it looks. But it was a word I learned in Kathmandu. I met this kid actually at a indoor bouldering competition in Kathmandu, and we got to talking. He's like, oh man, you should come. We were outside smoking together, and he's like, you should come to satsang later, you know, there's these really cool kids. And essentially what it is it's a meeting. It's almost like a verb there, where like people just get together to try, they discuss Hindu theology and philosophy and try to like boil it down, you know. It's like a debate, but no one's arguing. They're just like, well, what about
discussion
this? Very calm discussion. So and I thought, right when I heard it, I was like, man, that'd be a great band name.
Yeah. Well, it was one of the things that drew me to you guys at first, because I'm a yogi, and in yoga, it's part of what we do. Like after class, we sit down and in Jamaica, we'd say reasoning, you know, we sit and we reason, we talk about life, we talk about what's happening in your heart, talk about how it relates to yoga philosophy and stuff like that. So then after you went on this journey, and then you came back to America, or what was the process?
Yeah, I came back to America, and still I dirtbagged real hard for about another year. I have a beautiful partner that really, during my journey, she allowed me to go through it. But yeah, I mean, it was like climbing 5 days a week and skiing in the winter and reading
that
and writing.
That really sounds like dirtbag.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I had to ski five days a week. Oh my God.
Well, and that was just it's like, that was like the focal point. There was like, somewhere in playing outside, I'm going to find some answers. And I did.
Nice. Let's talk about alcoholism for a minute, because I grew up in a family of alcoholics, and I was never, I never was really a drinker, but I'm a total sugar addict. Like oh my God, I ate so much darn sugar. I'm trying to quit. It's like a thing for me in the last week. I don't know if you followed me online at all, but I've been trying desperately to quit sugar. But I come from a family. My father was an alcoholic, and I grew up in that experience, and I ran away when I was 17. I came back and I told my dad I wasn't going to move into the house unless he stopped drinking, and he actually did.
Nice.
But then I only lived there for a couple months before I moved out, and I never really knew him as a sober man until much later in life. He had a stroke, and it was like a butterfly had been cocooning for 66 years, and after that he came out of this stroke and he blossomed into this really, went from being like the meanest prick ever to being like this most beautiful man that I had ever known. And so I'm wondering, did you have that experience with yourself or with your family?
You know, for me, I was raised by my stepdad, but he married my mom when I was 2. Alcoholic, gambling addict, mean Irish asshole. You know, he just, for drill, you know, kicked the shit out of my brother and I when he would drink. And my brother went to the war in Iraq. He had gotten in a fight, and they essentially propositioned him, because he had been lightly talking to this army recruiter, and they're like, we can make these charges go away if you go. So when my brother dipped to Iraq, that was like my exit, you know. I stayed with a friend for a while and slept on people's couches, and then eventually moved to Chicago a year or so later and lived with my sister. For me, it was just, I kind of hit a crossroad, you know, like I was, where it was either I was going to be my dad or not, you know. And I looked at, I have 3 stepkids that I've been with for over 7 years that I call my own. And you know, looking at them was like, man, I don't want their memories of me to be this guy. Yeah. I want their memories to be a lot different.
Nice.
So I kind of used my dad as a compass of like, you know, what would he do in this situation, and then try to do the opposite.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's good. Well, I'm happy you're here, and I'm happy you're healthy, and
thanks.
I love your music. So let's talk about the music for a little while. What is your mission? Like, what as a group? What is your band's mission? Do you ever talk about that? Like, we are trying to blank.
You know, we've actually have a lot of resonance with people that struggle with addiction, and I think it's just because it's kind of coded in the lyrics. For me, I always come back to, like, I think the greatest lie that's ever been told is there's this whole, the industry, like every industry is essentially based around you're too fat, you're too skinny, you're too this, you're too that.
Yep.
And when you can get to a place like I did, that I still struggle with sometimes, of that like self-love of being like, no, man, you are enough. You're good enough. And you're great.
Yeah.
I would say that's the first mission, but also, you know, as a student of history and civil rights, and especially the current administration, you know, I think music has always been a form of news, you know, like how I found your music, it helped me process 2002 to 2004. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It really helped me process it. So like self-love, but also, you know, like a call to action in these times. I think it's really important for us to stand up for each other.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. I'm going to keep asking a couple more questions, but I want you guys to think, if you have any questions, and then I'll call on you. You can raise your hand just like in school, and I'll call on you.
Do you want me to tell you how I found your music?
Yeah.
Because it's a cool story.
Tell me the story.
Yeah. So, like I said, my brother got in this fight. School was always really tough for him. He didn't do well in school.
Yeah.
So he got in this fight, and he was propositioned, you know, you can go to basic training and go to the war in Iraq.
Wow.
Or join active duty, and we'll make this trouble go away. So he went, and at that time I was listening to, like, Public Enemy, Bad Religion, the U.S. Bombs, Anti-Flag, like, all punk rock hip-hop, anti-system. I heard Yell Fire riding in a friend's car.
Yeah.
And I just started crying and was like, no shit. Yeah. Like, this is what's up. And then that entire record, you know, like Time to Come Home, like that was the thing. You know, my brother went in over there so full of piss and vinegar, and we're going to do this. And I mean, like a few months in, he was like, dude, this is not what's up. I want to go the fuck home. And all of us do.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And I know, the documentary actually just found it. I know
I'm not alone.
Yeah. So watching that movie, and I just thought, it was such a moving thing to see everyone talking about the war, but then to see someone be like, "Well, I'm gonna go check this shit out."
Yeah.
And then we'll talk about it.
Yeah. Well, I was sitting on the bus just like this. We were watching TV, and I was like watching generals and politicians talk about the economic cost and the political cost of the war in Iraq when it first started. But they never showed anybody who was there. They never showed any human beings on the ground. They never talked to any soldiers who were there fighting. And I was like, I want to go there and see it with my own eyes. And so I took my guitar and video camera and a few friends, and we went there and we checked out what was going on. And I thought I would come back and write 10 angry songs speaking out against war. But really what happened to me when I went there and I spent time in families' homes, like going into the basement of a family who showed me where they hid during the bombings. And they said, you know, when the bombs would come, we'd hide in the basement. It would be pitch black because all the power would go out in the whole community. And we'd put blankets over our children in the middle of the floor. And I was like, why did you put blankets over kids if like a bomb is gonna fall? What's that gonna do? And they said, well, when the bombs go off, even if they're, you know, blocks away, all the glass shatters and it comes in and it hits us, you know. So to like hear experience of that, and as a father, you know, I live in San Francisco, I'm trying to think, what would I tell my kids the night before, you know, another country was gonna, you know, come and bomb us, you know? And I'm like sitting there, I don't even know what I would tell my kids, you know, like tell them the truth about what's going to happen to a 6-year-old or, you know, try to make up some fantasy or something, or there's going to be these loud noises or whatever. So, you know, then meeting soldiers there, I had that same experience that you described of your brother, of people who were super gung-ho when they went there. And then when they left, or while they were there, they were saying, you know, I thought we were over here because Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, right. And then there was, you know, he had been involved in 9/11. Now we find out these things aren't true, and what are we doing, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I was saying that I thought I'd write, you know, 12 angry songs about war, but I ended up writing a lot of songs about love, about connection, about how people get along, about families, yeah. about tenacity, you know, and, you know, that became my experience there. So
yeah, and it was, and for me too, like I still have this, like I was saying to you, I just had a really actually heavy experience with a Lakota elder mm-hmm. in Minnesota. He was one of the founding members of AIM, and yep. me, him, and Uncle Joe were sitting down, and he was telling me these stories of like four different times he's had someone that he knew to be an oppressor in his crosshairs, and he yep. had the moral question of like to pull the trigger or not to pull the trigger, and like processing all of this hate yeah. and this anger. And I had so much of that in me, especially my brother came home with severe PTSD.
Wow.
And the answer was, here's a pill. This one makes me feel this way. I can't take it anymore. Well, here's yeah. another one. You know, that was the thing. And I just watched him kind of unravel for a really long mm. time. And he's just now kind of coming back together. So when I was having this, my big theme recently is trying to find this balance of like, what is my philosophy on violence, nonviolence, anger, love? Because there's these things that make us angry. And when we're leaving, I was given this this piece of pipestone that he had carved into a crosshair. And he said, be careful what you put into your crosshairs, and don't yeah. let your anger become the collective anger. Don't right. let your fight become their fight.
Yeah. And is that part of your music now, is to communicate that?
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And it's important for me, too. I draw on counsel a lot, mm-hmm. you know. So if I'm, like I said, you know, like when we were like on day one, I was like, man, if we could sit down and talk, like people that are ahead of me,
yeah.
it's really important to me to talk to them. Because, like, especially with your music, mm-hmm. it's apparent that you have processed all yeah. of this stuff and come to this place. Like you said yesterday, I want the swing vote. You yeah. know, I want those in-betweens. And
yeah.
and I still struggle with that anger and the system that mm-hmm. I know is wrong.
Yeah. You know? I still struggle with it, too, on a daily basis. I'm you know, I wake up in the morning and I hear the news and I'm like, you know, I'm so pissed off.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And it's like, I got to go on stage. And yeah. You know, and sometimes, you know, I want to vent that, but I try to make it be in a way that people understand the passion behind my conviction and my beliefs, but that I'm still open to listening what other people have to say from different opinions or different walks of life or different political perspectives.
You nail that.
And I try to make music yeah. that does that. That opens that up.
I think I like Good to Be Alive today. That nails that.
Nice. Thank
you.
You
know,
thank
like
you.
I'm pissed off, but I'm a yeah. human. You're a human.
Yeah. Let's relate. So you guys got any questions?
Hey everybody, it's Michael Franti here on the Stay Human podcast. A few years back, my wife Sarah and I decided that we would start a nonprofit with the intention of bringing people with advanced stages of life-threatening illness, children and adults with special needs, and wounded veterans to see any live concert by any artist in any city in the world. And from that, Do It For The Love was born. If you have a friend or family member who needs music in that way, just write to us at doitfortheLove.org, and we'll make sure to get them out to see any concert in any city by any artist. Do It For The Love, y'all.
Go for it.
So you are skiing, you are rock climbing, you're doing all that stuff. What made you eventually decide, like, yep, I'm starting my band right now today? What was the
reason? Well, like I said, I had written these songs and started working through them, and then had another band made, and we were playing, and, you know, the furthest away from home we'd get is, like, Minnesota and stuff like that. But it was really, it was really when I started meeting people that were telling me, like, no, this is a thing, man, you can do that, you know, like Wookie Foot, Nako, mm-hmm. These people that were like, you got this, keep doing mm-hmm. it, especially when these two joined. Then it was like, then everyone was like, well, these two are so,
these guys
so
are,
damn talented.
These guys are badass.
Yeah, some bad dudes. So it went from being this, like, singy songwriting thing to us like forming these songs with stops and like this dynamic stuff. You know, Keller went to music school, Carl went for a little bit. They're both geniuses, just
yeah.
wicked intelligent dudes.
Right on. You know? Anybody else?
How did you decide like the genre or the type of music, or did it kind of find you? Was it something you knew ahead of time, or was it as you were writing the songs, it just said, hey, this is kind of where we're going?
She asked, how did you decide on the genre? I'm just saying it into the microphone. Yeah. How did you decide on your genre of music? Or did you just
it kind of came naturally, you know, because we listened to so much stuff. Like, we actually, I mean, today went from, like, bumping, like, an 80s pop playlist to, like, a Wilson Pickett radio, you know, like, and all across the board. But hip-hop has always been probably my biggest influence, hip-hop and reggae.
Yeah.
And then getting into soul music when I met him. Like, I've always liked old soul, but Keller really turned me on to, like, Anthony Hamilton, Bilal, you know, Erykah Badu, this whole Soulquarians crew, and anything Dilla ever did, you know.
Nice. So how did you get into that, living in Montana? Talk to me, Keller. Talk to me, man.
Can I grab?
Yeah, sit. Hop in. Hopped in Captain Kirk's seat right there.
Yeah. Here we go.
Yeah. So how did you get into that kind of neo soul? And
So I'm originally from Wyoming, and
the birthplace of neo soul.
Exactly, right? But my father was a music educator, and really inspiring for kids.
Yeah.
And especially jazz, that was like his big thing.
Yeah.
And so I come from like a really big jazz background.
Okay.
And through learning, you know, the jazz language and all of this like deep-rooted music,
yeah,
I found my own little path that stemmed from that into hip-hop and soul, especially like modern soul. And a lot of the guys I was playing with too in Montana and Colorado were like, oh, you dig Miles is playing on this record.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to dig this record that's like soul, but I mean, they cut Miles samples all the time. Like, check it out.
Yeah.
And through this, I mean, and especially like nowadays, like jazz isn't, you know, what we think of as jazz. It's like, there's so many different influences.
Yeah.
Soul and hip hop being like a big part, you know? And so that was like,
and there's so much of it just blending in, you know, like like Flying Lotus, who's doing like hip hop and really like serious jazz, and then all of like,
I mean, Robert Glasper, like when Black Radio came out, that like in a crazy way changed like what jazz was to be, you know.
Nice.
But yeah, like Flying Lotus and like the Thundercat crew.
Yeah.
I mean, even with like Kendrick Lamar's
with
album.
Kendrick Lamar, I was just going to say.
To Pimp a Butterfly Kendrick. Coming out.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
This is actually the new hip hop.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. And I mean,
yeah. It is incredible to see now how there's so many artists in hip hop today who are not even doing like classic songs. There's no hook in the song, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like if
like
you listen
freeform,
to yeah, or
like
Joey Badass, it's like 3 minutes and it's just rhymes, you know, the whole way through. Or MF Doom, who's like, I just love, you know, I just sit and listen to him all night long and just rhymes and flows, and there's never like a chorus to the song ever. It really is like,
but it's all like real storytelling stuff.
Yeah, storytelling,
and that's the roots for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think that's what drew me to that type of music too, is because of, like, there's, you know, a deep story in that. But on top of that, like, as a drummer, it just has, like, the fattest groove.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, not only am I, like, taking in this, like, really cool storytelling.
Yeah.
But also, you know, there's something I'm, like, bobbing my head to. I'm like, oh, you know, throw my headphones, like, sit behind my set.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember in junior high, I would spend hours in my, like, probably pissing off my mom, you know, just playing her records.
Nice. I still piss off my mom.
Yeah. Yeah. Heard that.
So to get from the drums to the vocals and the melody, you got to have something in between, and that is the bass. The bass, man, to get the rhythm to the melody. So hop in here, man, swap it out. Let's get Uncle Drew up in here. Oh no. Sorry, Uncle Carl. Uncle Carl. We already got Uncle Drew.
What's
Uncle
up?
Carl. Talk to me, man. Where are you from?
I'm actually originally from Chicago. And I grew up outside of the city, and then I lived downtown for about 12 years before Drew coaxed me out to Montana.
Yeah.
So it's I lived with him for, we lived together for a couple years down, and then.
So what was that like? Drew calls you, he's like, bro, I got this great thing. We're going to start a band, and we're going to, you're like, New York, LA, Miami, We're Billings. Going to Billings.
You know, he had kind of been slipping, you know, little hints here and there over the, over the years. And I had hit a point in Chicago where I was just kind of stuck in a rut. Mm-hmm. You know, I was working as a DJ in the bar scene out there, doing spinning top 40. And then I'd get like a break and I'd get to do some fun hip hop gigs. And
but what did you learn from that, though?
I kind of gained a respect for a lot of music that I normally would have never introduced myself to on my own.
Yeah.
So like dance music, and then different types of hip hop, like even just like respecting the role of pop music. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that was a big lesson because I was always kind of like the musical Puritan, you know.
Reason I asked that is because instruments. I had a similar thing. I mean, I grew up listening to, you know, in our house it was so much music. Between my brothers and sisters, everything from singer-songwriters like Jim Croce, you know, and Carly Simon and James Taylor to Earth, Wind & Fire and P-Funk and Parliament, Funkadelic. My first concert I ever went to was the Commodores.
Nice.
I was 12 years old, bought a ticket for $8, and I was there, and Lionel Richie comes up on this ascending white piano from below the stage. And he's playing Three Times a Lady on a white grand piano, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm hooked, you know? But then I went through this like period of total rebellion and I only listened to like hip hop and punk rock, you know? And, you know, and then my first band, the Beatniks, we toured with, you know, Fugazi was our opening act.
Oh, nice.
Our first tour of Europe, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, we played with all the, you know, the Operation Ivy guys who went on to become Rancid and Green Day and like the whole Gilman Street Project scene. You know, we were on the cover of Maximum Rock and Roll. And I went through this period of like just hating anything in pop music. And then I started listening to songs and going into. I fell in love with song smithing, like the actual writing of songs, and I can hear it.
What year was it?
Man, probably in the early 90s is when I first started getting really into like song. I had this band Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy, and we had a song called Television, the Drug of the Nation.
Yep.
And it was used by U2 to open their Zoo TV tour.
All right.
And so we got invited by U2 to go on tour. You know, we were driving a little white van around, and U2 called like yours
like Benicio.
And they're like, "Come out on the tour with us." And so now we're in a little white van following 200 trucks and tour buses, you know, to go and play in Yankee Stadium. You know,
that's awesome.
I saw Bono a few months ago in England, and I was like, you know, I remember when we played Yankee Stadium, you were the fourth artist to ever play there. It was like a really, you know, an amazing thing. There was the Pope, and then there was Nelson Mandela, and then there was Billy Joel, and then you too.
And Billy Joel.
You know, and I was like, but it was actually the Pope, Nelson Mandela, Billy Joel, and then my band played. We opened, and then you guys played.
Yeah. It fit me in right there.
But while I was out on tour with them, I saw the power of melody.
Yeah.
You know, and I saw like Bono sing like this, yo, and then he'd hold the mic up to the crowd and the whole crowd together would sing.
There was
this power of like rhythm, melody, singing along the songs that people know together.
Right.
And that the words and the meaning and the spirit behind the band was invested in like truth and human rights and dignity for all people and equality, you know, and I was like, there's something that's more powerful than just like standing on the stage and being pissed off and yelling at the crowd, and that there was another way of doing this. And so I started falling in love with Johnny Cash, you know, the Man in Black,
who
decided to only wear black for as long as there were poor people on earth.
Yeah.
You know, you know, that was his thing, you know, to identify. And you know, John Lennon. And then I would listen to Run DMC in the same way. Like, what is their song structure? How did they do it? How did these things come to be? So pop music is, there's something very worthy in it.
Right.
If it's, you know,
and
it's,
I think,
a great song.
It was really great for me to have that experience just and kind of open myself to that. Because then I think by the time I got out to Montana and started working with Drew, I was
open to, you know, creating, and had just, I think we had both grown so much because we had spent about 5 years, 6 years away, you know, yeah. just not playing, not, you know, we were communicating frequently, mm-hmm. but not in a musical setting. So when we arrived, we had developed as musicians, you know, and artists yeah. Enough. Yeah, we did. Wow. We did our first nice. Record. And yeah.
Congratulations.
And it was quite the experience. It was a tumultuous but really inspiring 10 days. Awesome. So it was great, and a lot of good has come from it. And then,
do you guys have any other questions for these guys?
Where to next? You guys stay on tour with
Mike? Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, we're with...
Do you want to pop back in, Drew?
Yeah, we'll be with these guys for 2 more days, and then we go meet up with Trevor Hall, and we do like a week and a half with him, and then we have...
Trevor Hall is an amazing singer-songwriter and philosopher, I think of him as. You know, he's a very like spiritual and mindful guy, but he has this really beautiful husky voice, and he plays incredible guitar. He like puts all the like his voice is here, and like this breath just goes over the microphone.
It's heavy. That was it's a sexy, great man. Description. Yeah. We'll do Trevor, a little bit of Trevor tour, and then festivals, and then we meet back up with these guys in August, and we get to play venues that I grew up. We always joke. I call them "I told you so" venues.
Nice.
The principal of my high school. I kept joking like I'm gonna send him Simon Estes tickets. And yeah. Like, told you.
Nice.
So thank you for that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. All right, so we're gonna wrap it up here, but I have one final question for you, which is, you know, we're in this time right now when there's so much division in the world politically, socially, about the environment, over sexuality, over religion. What role does music play today? And not just specifically your music, but it could be music in general, but also your music. What role does it play in trying to heal that?
I think music is just a universal language.
Mm-hmm.
Trump supporter, Bernie supporter, mm-hmm. gay, straight, whatever. No one, when you're like, do you like music? Are they going to be like, hell no. You know, like, so music is this thing where people can be like, we might not agree on this, but man, I love Michael Franti.
Yeah.
And then what happens is that vibration during a live show happens, and that's when people's hearts change, you know? Like, for me personally, I've had transcendent experience at shows that have made me cry, mm-hmm. that have made me leave.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So I think that's its role, is that it's not even changing minds, it changes hearts. And then when your heart starts changing, then your mind can open to the message that you're receiving.
Yeah.
So what I hope, like I said to you the other night, I was like, man, you guys just hit the love button. I don't know if I'm there yet, because I'm young and I'm still kind of pissed, but I'm getting there. and I want to be there.
Oh, I am too. I'm
yeah. But what I hope that we are able to do as a band is touch people in their hearts so they can receive the message of the important stuff, you know?
Yeah. Right on. Right. Well, thank you guys for being here.
Thank you.
People can find you on socials at
Satsang Movement or Satsang Music, and then our website is satsangmovement.com, and it's spelled Satsang, SATSANG.
Right on.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you guys for being here. We got Drew, Carl, Keller, and we've got all these amazing people here up in Ithaca, New York on our tour bus. Thanks for being here on the Stay Human podcast number 4. Stay tuned. Next week, we will be interviewing Sean Spicer.
Can I come?
Yeah, you can come, man. All right. All right. He'll be right here in the tour bus with us.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. Wouldn't it be good to have him alone for a minute?
It would be nice to have
him. I'm just kidding.
Johnny
just
Depp kidding. Got in trouble for that comment the other day.
Oh, man.
Anyway, thanks for being here, you guys. And thank you, studio audience, live studio audience. Yeah. Excellent.
All right. Respect.
Hey everybody, this is Michael Franti here on the Stay Human podcast, and I've traveled all throughout the world, and I've been to many inspiring places, and one of my favorites is Bali. I fell in love with his people and nature the first time that I came here in 2007. And at that time, I had a dream to build a place that was dedicated to music, soul, and wellness. And from that, the Soulshine Bali Hotel was born. It's my boutique hotel located in the heart of Bali, surrounded by beautiful rice fields and the most incredible sunsets that you might ever experience. We do over 50 retreats a year, or you can just come here and spend a night on your own. So follow us on Instagram at Soulshine Bali.